This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our interview today is about science, ethics, class, and race. One of the obstacles that used to face medical researchers was the difficulty of finding human cells that would keep multiplying in the culture of a petri dish. That problem was solved in 1951 when one doctor took cells from the cervix of a poor African-American woman who was dying of cervical cancer. Her cells were unique. They multiplied and multiplied and have been used in tens of thousands of research studies. They were essential in developing the Salk polio vaccine, as well as drugs for treating herpes, leukemia, influenza, and Parkinson's disease. They even went up in the first space missions so scientists could study the impact of zero gravity on human cells. This line of immortal cells that have contributed so much to science is called HeLa cells, named after Henrietta Lacks, the woman from whom the original cells were taken without her knowledge. The H-E in HeLa is for Henrietta, the L-A is for Lacks. It took 25 years for her family to find out about HeLa cells. Her daughter Deborah wondered, if our mother's cells have done so much for medicine, how come her family can't afford to see doctors? My guest, science journalist Rebecca Skloot, has written a new book about this amazing story called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca Skloot, welcome to Fresh Air. What makes Henrietta Lacks' cells, the HeLa cells, so special, so different from other cells?
It's sort of a mystery, in a sense. There are a few things we know for sure about them. I mean, one of them is that they were the first immortal human cell line ever to grow in culture. Scientists put them in culture in 1951, and they just never died. They kept growing and growing and growing. And scientists had been trying to do that for decades, and it had never worked. She had, when she went to the hospital, she had a tumor on her cervix that was about the size of a dime. And within 6 months, nearly every organ in her body was taken over by tumors. So her cancer grew incredibly fast in her body. When scientists put them in culture, they just took off. They doubled every 24 hours, and they sort of piled on top of each other and grew in this enormous sort of quantities that no cells had ever done before.
So the cells that the doctors took that have reproduced so much and have been used in so much research, those were her cancerous cells that they took?
Yes. Yeah, they took both. They took a small sample of her tumor without her knowing, and they took a small sample of her normal tissue. And this was part of a larger study. So to sort of put it into historic context, in 1951, when she went to the hospital, the pap smear had just recently been invented. Very large numbers of women were dying of cervical cancer. And the pap smear had reduced those numbers a bit, but no one really knew exactly how to diagnose cervical cancer yet. So doctors would do a pap smear, and sometimes they would look at it and say, oh, that's just, it's a bacterial infection, and they'd give a woman antibiotics when she actually had cancer. Other times they'd look at it and say, oh, that's cancer, and give a woman, you know, do a hysterectomy on a woman who actually only had an infection. So this doctor at Hopkins decided that if he could just grow cervical cancer cells and normal cervical cells in culture, you could look at them under the microscope and establish, this is what a cancer cell looks like, this is what, you know, a normal cell looks like, and it would help figure out this diagnosis issue. So he took samples from her normal tissue and from her tumor, and the normal ones died very quickly in culture. They never really went anywhere. So it was this, it was the cancerous cells that really took off.
Well, it's amazing that they can use cancer cells for medical research, since cancer cells are so different from healthy cells. So is that a problem for the research? How can they use cancer cells?
No, it's you know, there are things that are completely abnormal about HeLa because they're cancer. But there are a lot of things that cancer cells do that normal cells do. You know, they metabolize, they create energy, they, you know, they get infected by viruses. So there's a lot that is that you can study that applies to all cells using cancer cells. The other big thing is that they're used almost like factories. You can infect them with a virus or various other things that you want to produce, and they'll grow those viruses in large quantities. And they're also sort of, they're like a baseline. They're almost treated like the white lab mouse or the fruit fly. Part of why they're so useful is that they just grow in these massive quantities.
Henrietta Lacks, her story is so interesting. I love the way you balance the personal story and the science story in your book. Henrietta Lacks was a poor African-American woman who in 1951, when she had cervical cancer, she'd never heard the words biopsy or cervix before. And I was kind of shocked to read a little bit about her medical story. First of all, at Johns Hopkins University, where she was in the colored ward. There was a colored ward in 1951.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing I found kind of shocking was the radiation treatment that she got. And I want you to describe that treatment.
Yeah. The treatment was a standard for the day, regardless of where you went for your treatment, pretty much, was that the doctors would take tubes of radioactive material called radium and literally sew the tubes to the surface of the cervix. They would put them in little pouches. And at first they would stick a few tubes up inside the cervix, and then they would sew the pouches full of these tubes to the outside, and they would leave them there for a few days, just sort of emitting radioactive material inside of you. And, this is the kind of stuff where it's the radioactive material that glows. It's that kind of radioactive material. And so it would essentially burn off the cancer. And then they would remove the tubes and send you home.
Was this a standard procedure then, or is this considered experimental?
Absolutely standard. And this is one of the interesting things. It's sort of an important point in the history of Henrietta Lacks. Her story has often been held up as one of, these sort of, awful white doctors who did these really kind of vicious treatments to her and stole her cells without telling her because they knew they'd be valuable. And that really wasn't the case at all. They were taking cervical cancer tissues from any woman who walked into Hopkins with cervical cancer. And this was absolutely the standard treatment. And in fact, it was considered the sort of top of the line. But, there are other questions about, this was a colored ward. This was the Jim Crow era. The reason she was at Hopkins in the first place was because she was black, and there were not really many other hospitals around where she could have gotten treated. She also had no money, and Hopkins was a charity hospital. So she was in the public wards. And, there have been plenty of studies that have looked at how segregation affected healthcare delivery. So she did get the standard care of the day. But she was definitely sent home many times after her radiation treatment. She came back complaining of various pains and was sent home and sent home and sent home until she eventually refused to go home and said, no, put me in the hospital. And at that point, her cancer had spread so much. And there probably wasn't anything the doctors could have done either way. But, the question of how race played into her health care is a hard one to answer.
So you were able to tell this story about Henrietta Lacks, her cancer, her cells, how her cells were used scientifically, in part because you met members of the family. Once you decided that you were fascinated by the story, you tracked down the Lacks family. Of course, Henrietta Lacks was dead, but her daughter, Deborah, was alive. So how did you make contact with Deborah? And how old was she when you did?
She was in her early 50s when I finally got in touch with her, and she was very hard to find, and I realized later because she didn't want to be found. But I eventually tracked down a scientist who had her contact information, essentially, and he was the only scientist at that point who had done anything to sort of thank the family for the HeLa cells. He had organized a conference in Henrietta's name. So he essentially grilled me for about 3 days over the phone just to find out what my intentions were and to basically see if I was someone he was willing to put in touch with the family.
As opposed to what? Were they used to people getting in touch with them for questionable reasons?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know it at the time, but I came along in the 90s, and at that point I was just another of a very long line of white people coming who wanted something having to do with the cells. So scientists coming saying, we want to take samples from you to do research to learn more about the cells. Journalists coming and wanting to, essentially tell the same story over and over and over again. This, cells taken from this woman without her knowledge, lived all these years. Sort of, isn't it amazing? That story had been repeated over and over again in the media. And the reason why it was so upsetting for the family is because no one ever told them anything. The first time the family heard about the cells was 25 years after she died. No one had ever told them these cells had grown, and yet they're all over the world being used in this research. And the way they learned about it was essentially a scientist called them wanting to do research on the family to learn more about the HeLa cells. This was the very early days of gene mapping, and they thought if they could take some samples from her kids and they could use their genes to study HeLa cells more. So Henrietta's husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was, and he got this phone call one day, and the way he understood it was essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in the laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer. which wasn't what the scientist said. But, you know, the scientist said, we need to look at your HLA markers and your this and your that. And he had no idea what the science was. He actually, you know, to him, the only cell he'd ever heard of was the, you know, the kind in the jail where one of his sons was at that point. And Deborah was in her 20s, and she had feared her 30th birthday her entire life because she knew her mother died at 30, in her 30s, or she was diagnosed at 30, died at 31. So she knew her mother died right around 30, and she figured the same thing would happen to her. No one had told her why her mom died. So it made perfect sense for doctors to be calling saying, it's time to test you for this thing that killed your mother. So the scientists came and took samples from the family and left, and the family waited for their cancer results. They would call the Hopkins switchboard and say, we need our cancer results, and the you know receptionist at Hopkins had no idea what they were talking about. And the scientists were doing research on the cells, and they would then send them to other scientists. So the family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and it was all pretty terrifying for Deborah. She didn't know if this stuff that they were doing hurt her mother. You know, they would say things like, we sent this stuff to the moon, and she would think, like, it, you know, was that okay for her mom? And when they injected them with chemicals and radiation, she was very worried that this was doing something very damaging to her mother's, either her mother's spirit or actually her mother might feel the pain of this stuff. So there was a lot of fear surrounding that.
So were you in a position to explain to Deborah what this was about once you found out?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, you know, once she really did start to talk to me after about a year, one of the ways in which I was able to kind of finally win her trust was to say, look, I want the same thing you want. I want to find out what happened. I want to tell her story. You know, Deborah, the one thing I got from our first phone call was that she was desperate to know who her mother was. Deborah was 2 when her mom died, so she had no memory of her and had spent a lot of her life really fixated on wanting to understand her mother's story and, you know, did she like to dance and what was her favorite color? And, you know, she grew up with a lot of men. She was very badly abused and she held up her mother as this person who could have saved her. And so I knew that she really wanted to know about her mother. So I would go and, as I learned stories about her mother by interviewing distant relatives and finding the people she grew up with, I would call and leave messages on Deborah's voicemail saying, you know, hey, I talked to your, you know, cousin Cliff, and he told me this great story about your mom, you know, and they used to do this. And so eventually she called me and said, okay, fine, I'll talk to you, but, you know, only if you don't hide anything from me. And I said, hey, you can come with me if you want on my research trips. I will share with you everything I learn. I'm not trying to hide anything from you. So then, you know, she really did learn about the cells as we were going, you know, as we were doing this research. We'd go into labs and scientists would explain to her, you know, the basics of the cells. So she really did eventually learn about it.
Let's get back to Henrietta Lacks, who had a body riddled with cancer, and her cancer cells have been reproduced by scientists, and those cells have been used in so much medical research for decades. It's quite ironic that ironic isn't exactly the word. The family didn't find out about this until 25 years later. And the family is in a position where they can't always afford to go to a doctor. Some of them have, correct me if I'm wrong, some of them have health insurance, some of them don't. They've never seen a penny. They've gotten very little recognition for what their mother contributed. Legally, are they owed anything now?
Legally, no. In part because it's not clear who would owe them anything. You know, the cells were grown at Hopkins by George Guy, who then gave them to everyone who wanted them for free. He just gave them out because this was this unbelievably exciting development in research. He's like, here, everybody, do great things with these. And then it was down the road, you know, someone started at the first company this was the first company to ever sell a human tissues or human cells. So somebody started a company selling them because scientists needed that. And that led to, multi-billion dollar corporations now. So it's impossible to calculate how much money has been made off of them. But no, they're historically speaking, there have been other cases where people have found out, hey, someone's using my tissues for research, and they've made, you know, in one case, a scientist patented someone's cells and licensed the patent for millions of dollars, and the man sued, and the court said, no, people don't have the right to profit off their body because the fear is that it would interfere with science.
This might seem a little arcane to people, you know, whether this woman's cells should have been paid for, or what kind of acknowledgement she should get. But you point out in your book, we all have cells that are stored someplace. I never really thought of it that way, but is that true? We all have cells that are stored someplace?
Pretty much. It's hard to say everybody does. But yeah, the majority of Americans at this point certainly have it very likely have their tissues on file somewhere.
How? Like why?
Well, so there are a lot of different ways that this happens. And one of them is through, you know, you go to the doctor and you get a biopsy. In a lot of cases, you know, you sign a consent form that says the doctor can dispose of this however, you know, he or she sees fit. Some cases it says can use this for educational research or research purposes. And that basically means they can take them and store them and do whatever they want with them. And in a lot of cases, so any child born in the U.S. after since the 1960s, it's law that you have to all newborns have to be tested for genetic diseases. So everybody gets the little blood prick, and they test you for diseases, which is great. We need that. It's saved a lot of lives. But then those samples are often saved. So pretty much any child born since the 60s has their stuff on file somewhere. Circumcision samples are often saved.
Where is all this stored?
Oh, there are banks and banks and banks. I mean, there are so many different places. Some of them are for-profit. Some of them are non-profit. Some of them are in hospital basements. The range is really huge. Some of them are just these enormous factories, and the others is like some guy's basement, you know, with a bunch of vials in them.
And are most of these cells just kind of sitting there as opposed to being used for research?
We don't really know. A lot of them are being used in research. Some of them probably aren't. This is the thing. It's just this is something that's been sort of building for a long time. And it's only recently scientists are starting to sort of say, wow, you know, these fetal blood samples are this incredibly valuable resource. We should create these banks and sort of start maybe being a little more organized about it. It's interesting. There's actually over Christmas a lawsuit. There's a lawsuit. There were actually two of them, one in Texas and one in Minnesota, where some families found out that their children's fetal blood samples had been stored and were being used in research. And they sued the states. So over Christmas, a court actually ruled in favor of these families in the state of Texas. And the state of Texas had to destroy over 5.3 million samples taken from kids, you know, and stored for research without their knowledge or their parents' knowledge. And that is huge. That's never happened before. No court has ruled in favor of the tissue, you know, quote unquote donors in any case like this. And having the result be we're going to destroy all this stuff very sort of quietly. I mean, literally, very few people even seem to notice that this happened is a bit disturbing, I think, on the larger scale for scientists, right? So one of the big fears and one of the reasons this whole issue of how should we deal with consent and property rights and those things with cells, one of the reasons it hasn't been dealt with for so long is because it's so complicated. And what my reaction to that Texas thing was, I saw that and thought, uh-oh, if we start having state-by-state rulings like this, where one state destroys 5.3 million, one point state, you know, and state by state, we start having these things happen. It's sort of preempting this larger discussion of what to do with the samples, and how to do this in a way that isn't going to hurt science, but will also protect people.
Meanwhile, getting back to the HeLa cells, the cells mm-hmm. that reproduce so well that so many scientists have used for research, the cells from Henrietta Lacks, the HE for Henrietta, the LA and HeLa from Lacks, these cells are now actually contaminating a lot of experiments. What's gone wrong?
Yeah, well, this started in the beginning and no one knew it. So, when scientists first grew HeLa cells, when George Guy first grew HeLa cells, people thought he had just discovered the recipe and the sort of formula for doing it. And so everyone started taking samples from themselves and their kids and their patients and really quickly created this huge library of samples, which was being used in all sorts of important research. And in the 60s, at some point, one scientist basically realized these were pretty much all HeLa cells. And this was an enormous shock to the field. This was a big controversy. It meant potentially, you know, some people were potentially fabricating data, and there was millions of wasted research dollars. And the thing is that HeLa cells can float on dust particles in the air. They can travel on unwashed hands. You know, if you use a pipette to suck cells out of one dish and put them in another, and then you reuse that, you can transfer HeLa cells other places. And because HeLa cells are so hardy, they will essentially outgrow any cell that they encounter, and the other cell will die because it can't keep up, and HeLa cells take over. So what, you know, scientists thought they had all of these samples and, you know, this, and it all turned out to be HeLa. And, you know, it started this decades-long quest to try and, from a few scientists trying to clean up the contamination problem. And it's still happening. I mean, there's HeLa cells are still contaminating cell lines all over the place.
Your father, in 1988, had a viral infection that caused brain damage, and it immobilized him. He was in a clinical trial after this viral infection. And since this relates so well to the subject that you've been writing about, except it's much closer to your life history, what was the study that your father was involved in? And did he even know he was in a study?
Yeah, he did. He volunteered for the study. So he got this viral infection that caused this brain damage. No one knew what was really wrong with him at that point. There was the late 80s, so people were like, maybe this is some strange form of AIDS we haven't seen, or maybe it's cancer. And they were throwing around all these scary diagnoses. And eventually he got lumped under the umbrella of chronic fatigue syndrome, which was at that point where they were putting everyone that they couldn't really explain what was wrong with them. You know, he can't move. He's got chronic fatigue syndrome. So there was this study that was looking at this particular drug to see if it would help people with quote unquote chronic fatigue syndrome. So he enrolled in it, and there were a lot of sort of ethical questions about it in the end. And, you know, I was 16. I had just gotten my driver's license, and he was unable to drive because of his brain damage. So I would drive him several times a week to this hospital where he'd get these infusions of either a placebo or the drug. And I would just sort of hang out and watch him and these other patients being used in the study. And at the time, you know, it was this incredible lesson for me as a kid, and I don't even think I realized I was learning it at the time, of like the hope of science and, you know, really thinking this thing was going to fix my dad. You know, he went from a marathon runner to being this guy who couldn't move almost overnight. And that was the same year I first learned about the HeLa cells. So I was 16 and in this basic biology class, and my teacher, you know, as all biology teachers do, at some point they say, oh, these are the first human cells, immortal cells ever grown in culture, and they're still alive today, even though she died in 51. Like, people learn the basics of this in biology. And for some reason, my teacher knew her name. He said, you know, her name was Henrietta Lacks, and she was black. And I was like, why do we know that about her? Well, what else? And my first question was, did she have kids? What do they think about this? You know, do they know about this? And I think that the reason why I asked those questions is because I was in the midst of that myself, having my own parent used in research, and sort of feeling all the emotions that went along with that. So I, you know, immediately went up after class and asked my teacher, so, you know, what do they know about her? Tell me more. And he just was like, sorry, that's it. That's all there is. And that sort of planted the seed that, you know, all these years later became my book.
With your father's story, like watching him from the age of 16 have this mysterious disability that radically transformed his life, and then watching him slowly try to put the pieces back together to the extent that he was capable of doing that, how did that affect your sense of the vulnerability and the resilience of the human body?
Oh, I'm sure it affected it a lot, probably more than I ever have really thought about. And I think part of it also gave me a different appreciation for just illness in general and what a transformative experience it can be internally and sort of emotionally. And he's a very different person now than he was before he got sick, you know, and a lot of people say this happens to people often when they go through really, you know, difficult illnesses. He's a much warmer guy. He's a much happier guy. He realized how important, you know, people in his life are and things. So I think that more than anything, that's something I got out of it, is how transformative it can be to sort of fight through something like that. You know, and I saw that with Deborah. I mean, you know, Deborah, watching her go through this sort of arc of learning about her mother and the traumas of all of that, and then coming out the other side was so inspiring. I mean, she was she's, you know, the strongest woman I've ever met in my life. You know, she had no education really, and she had a very difficult time reading. So everywhere we'd go, she'd carry this little tattered dictionary around with her and look up words that scientists said to try to follow what was going on. I mean, she so badly wanted to learn things that, you know, it was really inspiring to watch. And then, you know, she did come out the other side eventually, feeling very differently about the cells and really embracing the great things that they did for science. And, you know, so the transformation that trauma can cause is really amazing.
You write in your introduction that while you were trying to make sense of the history of cell culture and the ethical debate surrounding the use of human tissues in research, you were accused of conspiracy, slammed into a wall both physically and metaphorically, and that you eventually found yourself on the receiving end of something that looked a lot like an exorcism. So choose the best story from those examples and tell us what happened.
There was actually a moment during the research process, and Deborah and I are traveling together and learning various things about the cells, where someone actually performed essentially like a faith healing, laying hands on her to remove the cells from her. You know, this sort of take the burden of these cells from this woman, Lord, she can't take it anymore. And I was, you know, the reporter sitting in the room with my notebook, just sort of scribbling notes going, oh, my God, I've never seen anything like this. And, you know, they're screaming and praying and singing. And then all of a sudden, you know, he said, take these cells from this woman. And he turned to me and he put his hands on either side of my head and said, give them to her. And I just went, oh, you know, as a journalist, this is not something you necessarily expect. And, you know, I'm not a religious person and I'd never encountered anything like that. And it was such a powerful moment for so many reasons, which I'll leave to people to read in the book. But for me, that was actually the moment I knew I had to be in the story. I had been doing all this research for years. And, you know, I would come home from these, you know, research trips and I would tell my friends and my family these stories. And they kept saying, you have got to put this in the book because the family's reaction to you is the thing that illustrates how really damaged they've been by this. And how are you going to show this any other way? And I was like, no, this is not my story. This is their story. I actually have issues with writers who put themselves in books where they don't belong. So I was like, no, it is not my story. And I just refused for years. My agent would harass me about it. And then that moment when he said, give them to her, I just went, oh, God, I have to be in the book. You know, and I mean, it wasn't like my first reaction, but that I realized in that moment that I had no choice because I had really become essentially a character in the book. And that I realized it would sort of be dishonest to leave myself out.
So did you or Deborah feel any different after this?
Oh, she was utterly transformed. Yeah. It was pretty incredible to watch. And not only was she really released from so much that was so much of the upset, you know, or so much of the anxiety and fear that she was going through. But she was also completely transformed in her relationship towards me. You know, she didn't trust me. Even once she started talking to me, she was terrified that I was going to do something to her. She would have these moments where for long periods she was fine. And then she would have moments where she would think maybe Johns Hopkins sent me and I'm going to take her somewhere and take her cells. And, you know, she would have these kind of paranoid moments that out of context sound a little crazy. But when you look at them in the grand scheme of her life and think, okay, someone came to her, you know, 25 years after her mother died and said, hey, part of your mother's still alive and there's enough of it that if you put her cells end on end, they'd wrap around the earth three times, you know, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons. And that was true, you know, and so what's too strange? Her entire barometer for what sounded possible was just completely off kilter because of the things that were done with the cells. And so she would have these moments of utterly fearing me. I wasn't allowed to ride in her car. So we would go on these trips and take two cars and I would follow her. And after that moment that everything changed in our relationship, she actually, that was the day she first let me get in her car. And so
why? Because that, part of her was now in you?
Yeah,
in
I think,
mind.
And yeah, well, right, and I had, yeah, like part of the cells was in me, and I think also because in that moment, one of the things that, you know, the person who was performing this faith healing, or laying on of hands, I guess, one of the things he kept saying is, you're not alone in this. She kept saying, I can't take this by myself. I can't do this. And he said, you know, you're not alone. And then he did that, you know, sort of transferring the cells to me. And I think part of it was realizing that, yeah, I was actually there and in this really long haul with her. You know, I mean, this book took 10 years to write. And, you know, I think that was the moment she realized I wasn't going anywhere for real. And that I was not going to hurt her.
So when the cells were, quote, transferred to you by the faith healer, did you feel anything transformative?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, this religious, you know, the faith and spiritual stuff in this story, it's pretty heavy. You know, her family really, some members of her family believe that Henrietta is the Lord's first immortal being, you know, chosen and brought back to life as these cells to cure diseases. And, you know, and she sometimes causes problems. You know, Deborah always said the whole contamination thing was Henrietta getting back at scientists. She's like, you know, you don't piss Henrietta off. She will sick HeLa cells on you. You know, she'll have them come and destroy your lab. But all of that was very hard for me to kind of wrap my head around initially. I was raised, I have no religious background at all in terms of that stuff. So, but it was transformative. In a lot of ways, what the thing that was building in me, which became even in some cases, in some way more powerful right then, was the weight of this story, the responsibility that I felt to tell this story and to get it right, to not, you know, to write it in a way that people will want to read and will get through and all of those things. And to just get it all out of my head and onto the page, I felt such a burden of that. And in a lot of cases, I was scrambling. You know, Henrietta's generation was in their 80s and 90s as I was doing the research for the book. And in some cases, some of her immediate relatives would die right before I was supposed to interview or right after I interviewed them. And I always had this sense that I was scrambling to keep up, to get this history as it was disappearing. And I, especially after that moment, like there was something about that where I was like, okay, this really, I am doing this. I'm writing this book. I must do this right. And, you know, do it justice. And I would get terrified. Like there were moments when I would travel or something where I would think, if something happens to me, what's going to happen to this book? Like, and I would call, I have this, one of my best friends is a writer. He's at the Washington Post. And I would call him sometimes like middle of the night and say, okay, I'm going on a trip. If anything happens to me, my interview transcripts are in this box. My tape recordings are here. And you need to swear to me you're going to write this book. If I die, write this book. You know, and my dad too. Like, and I had assigned them sections. I'm like, okay, Dad, you write this part. You know, my friend's Mike, you write this part and you guys have to swear to me you're going to do this. And I had that kind of, you know, sort of.
So you're kind of amazed that you survived and the book is published.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And I was terrified something would happen to the research materials. My poor boyfriend had to move these boxes. Every time we moved or traveled anywhere, I brought my research with me because I thought I was afraid something was going to. So I would go to this house in the middle of nowhere to work on it sometimes. And my boyfriend, we couldn't mail the boxes because I was scared something would happen to them. I wouldn't let the movers touch them. And so my boyfriend would lug, you know, and this is pre-digital. So we're talking, you know, file cabinets full of folders and books and tapes. And we would pack them all into this car and then we couldn't leave it. I mean, I was so protective of this stuff and really a lot of it. I mean, I had always felt really that it was so important to tell the story, but something about that moment with that faith healing, it became it became much bigger than me, I think.
Since you raised so many ethical questions about medical research in the story and informed consent, were there any ethical questions that entered into your relationship with Henrietta Lacks's daughter, Deborah?
Oh, absolutely. And in a lot of ways, I think this book is just as much about journalism, you know, and the ethics of telling people's stories as it is about science. You know, there are so many questions about, you know, who has the right to tell your story? And do you own your own story? And, you know, there are a lot of questions about that. You know, one of the first questions that once Deborah's family agreed to talk to me, the first question they asked was, what are you going to pay us? You know, here you are, yet another white person who showed up at our house wanting to do something that you are going to potentially profit off of that we might get nothing out of. You know, at the time, I was in my 20s. I was paying for all my research using student loans and credit cards. And I was like, I don't even know if this thing's ever going to get published. And, you know, but I said to them, you know, and there is a code of ethics in journalism that says, you know, you don't pay people for their stories. It changes the relationship. It becomes a business partnership, not a sort of journalistic endeavor. And I felt like, you know, I felt like I couldn't pay them for their story. But at the same time, I didn't want to be another person who just sort of came along, got stuff from them and left. So what I told them in the beginning is if this thing ever actually happens, I'm going to create a foundation, a Henry Lacks Foundation that has a scholarship fund. And I will put some of my money into the scholarship fund from the book, and it will be open for any scientist, university, corporation, anybody in the world can donate to this thing. And it would be a scholarship fund that would help essentially educate any of the descendants of Henrietta Lacks and, others in similar situations. And I said this, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I didn't know how you create a foundation or scholarship fund, but I did. I did it. And so the foundation actually just went live. And my hope is that, and Deborah was, this was something that was very important to Deborah. She came to realize as we were going through this whole book process that one of the biggest problems with in the story was that she didn't have an education. So she came to a point where she realized if she had just been able to, ask the right questions to the scientists, and if she had had a little more exposure to science, even on a basic level, she might not have been so scared and this stuff might not have been so traumatic for her. And she might have just been able to say at some point, hey, wait a minute, this isn't clear to me, and just to sort of be comfortable questioning things a bit more. So for her, one of the big important elements of this is, she wants the future Lacks generations to be educated. She does not want them to have to go through what she went through, carrying her dictionary around, trying to understand something so scary to her. And so I felt like that was what I could do for that. But then, there were a lot of other ethical issues that I sort of grapple with in the book about telling the story. And in the end, that's why I'm in it, because I felt like if I wasn't, then that would be journalistically unethical in a sense. I felt like I had to show the impact I had on this family, which, I put them in some pretty hard situations that had some pretty bad effects on Deborah in the moment. I think in the end it was all good for her, but, there were some pretty bad things happened. And so I felt like that all had to be in there as sort of just to be upfront about what was going on in the story and my role in it.
Rebecca Skloot, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Skloot's new book is called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The statement usually ascribed to Peter Buck of REM that only 1,000 people bought the Velvet Underground's albums in the 1960s, but every one of them started a band, also holds true for a Southern band whose albums in the 1970s sold even fewer copies than the Velvets, but whose posthumous reputation is nearly just as large. Rhino Records has released Keep an Eye on the Sky, a 4-disc collection of recordings, demos, and outtakes by Big Star, as well as an expanded version of I Am the Cosmos, a collection of recordings by founding member Chris Bell. Today, rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of the band with the worst luck in American rock history.
She's a schemer and she makes me mad, but I love her a lot. Those lonely nights I was in a big room playing my thing, so I wish she were here. She can be so kind when she's not trying to hide. She tries not to love me, but she
Big Star was almost named the Sweden Cream. Taking a break from recording at Ardent Studios in Memphis one evening, the four band members, Alex Chilton, Chris Bell, Jody Stevens, and Annie Hummel, were standing outside talking about what to name this group which had suddenly come into being. There were two buildings across the street. One was an ice cream shop, the other a Memphis grocery chain with a big red star as a logo. Bell, Stevens, and Hummel were school friends, and Chris and Jody worked at Ardent at night, learning how to run a recording studio. They were rabid Anglophiles. Chris often told his brother he'd been born in the wrong country at the wrong time and should be leading a band like The Who or The Kinks. Certainly, they wrote some interesting songs, and at one point, John Fry, one of the owners of Ardent, went to New York with a tape they'd made, only to have it turned down as being too derivative of the Beatles. Into this situation came Alex Chilton, who, as a 16-year-old, had tasted major success as the frontman of the Box Tops, whose hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby had given him an education on how to be ripped off by your record company. He'd used Ardent for some Box Top sessions, and now that he was free of his contract, he dropped by to see his old friend Chris Bell. Soon, he was at Ardent at night, too, and writing songs with Chris. They were good. The best Big Star songs are a distinctly American take on the kind of pop the British invasion had brought to this country, and far from the sort of southern rock the Allman Brothers and others were doing in 1972, when Big Star's ironically named debut, number one record, was released on the new Ardent Records label. Ardent did recording for Stax when Stax's studios were overbooked, and with Stax being distributed by Columbia, Ardent, as a division of Stax, was assured of blanket distribution. But that's not what happened. A casualty of machinations within Columbia, number one record barely got distributed at all. It got a rave review in Rolling Stone, but a rave review is not much good if you can't buy the album. Chris Bell, who'd been working for years on this band before Alex Chilton came along, was devastated. To make things worse, his longtime girlfriend left him. Words were spoken, fists flew, and by the time it was over, Chris was in a psychiatric institution. Alex and the other two continued making demos, and a couple of years later, in 1974, a second album, Radio City, appeared. It was even better. September Girls would be a hit, but not for Big Star, and not for over a decade, when the Bangles recorded it in a more pop-friendly world. Andy Hummel threw in the towel and went back to school. Meanwhile, Chris Bell was recuperating. Like Chilton, he was from a wealthy family, so it was relatively easy for him to pack up with his brother and head to Europe for an extended trip. He took with him two recordings he'd made, and was honored when Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick mixed one of them for him. But he couldn't get any record companies to bite on I Am the Cosmos or the equally excellent You and Your Sister, even after EMI had reissued the two Big Star albums in England. So he went back to Memphis and took a job with his family's restaurant management company while recruiting a band of young kids to work with him. Coming home from a rehearsal late at night a few days after Christmas 1978, he went off the road at high speed and was killed. Rumors persisted among the growing Big Star underground, though, that there was a third album in the can. Tracks cut in 1974 by Alex and Jody, who was still working at Ardent as an engineer, and overseen by producer Jim Dickinson. There was, in fact, and it was experimental, eccentric, and uncommercial. Just what the fans wanted.
At nighttime I go out and see the people. Echoes cool and hurrying on my way. Dressings are sweet, all the people to see. They're looking at me, all the people to see. And when I set my eyes.
By the time the album, titled either Third or Sister Lovers, depending on which version you bought, came out in 1978 on the tiny PVC label, Big Star was history. Jody continued to work at Ardent, and Alex spent a number of years washing dishes in a New Orleans restaurant. Eventually, however, the band's reputation hit critical mass and reissues became available. All those kids who'd bought number one record in Radio City had bands now, and their music was called power pop. Chilton emerged reluctantly to record some more and produce the Cramps. He still wasn't a big star, but he was a legend.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France and blogs at wardinfrance.blogspot.com.